WrestleMe Mark!
WrestleMe Peter!
We were just talking about a cool wrestling move.
We talk about wrestling off air too.
Off air too. You're not going to get to hear it unless Patreon too.
Electric Boogaloo. We were talking about PWG, the Battle of Los Angeles. Mm. There's a little clip, a little gif. It sort of went viral, didn't it?
It did, because it looked dangerous.
It did. Somebody comes off the ropes doing a big leapy dive, and out of nowhere comes basically a cutter, an RKO, from someone else who's also high up.
Yeah.
And that looked spectacular. Yeah. But we were saying, I mean, I love the Battle of Los Angeles. It's a annual tournament. It's been happening since the late 2000s, I think. And it's some of the biggest stars in the industry have competed in it and won in it.
Yeah.
And every year it's pretty spectacular. Mm. They have a very, very good booking ability of taking people who are absolutely on the cusp of becoming the next big thing.
Yeah.
And they have them just at the right time. And the problem for them is they're not a streaming service. They don't kind of go watch it live.
Why don't they just?
Mad in this day and age not to be able to watch it live over three nights. But they're very much like, it will come out on Blu-ray and DVD in August.
Yeah. I bought a capture card. We could go live with WrestleMe right now if we wanted to.
Yeah.
Crying out loud.
Nobody wants that. We made that very, very clear. Look, we are going to be doing quite a lot of exciting stuff, though. I think we're going to be doing a little bit more audio-visual.
Audio-visual.
When we go to America.
Yeah.
Because that makes everything tax deductible. Good news. I am really disappointed that nobody who is an important part of the American wrestling scene has basically gone, I hear you guys are coming to Texas. Mm. Well, I own a 2,000 seat venue.
A shoe. I own a shoe.
I own a gun because I am from Texas. And if you want to do your show while I hold the gun against your head, you're all right, mate. But I'd still really like someone to approach us and say, even if they kind of go, can I come to your Airbnb and see you do a show?
Yeah.
So, yeah, as long as you can, you know, meet the cost of the Airbnb for the time we're there, then of course, yes. Yes, we'd be happy.
Very
to.
Affordable Airbnb, I found. So much cheaper than the hotels.
Slightly disappointing. Like, we signed up for a thing called WrestleCon, which you get a sort of big ticket, and that gives you access to all the different sort of things.
Yeah.
Slight disappointment, no one's got back and said, hey, I see the two names on the thing. Would you two
you
guys...
You keep saying this, but we're so... You know how many viewers we've got. I'm not saying we, aka you, are
wrestling.
Not good.
It's wrestling.
Yeah, I know, but there's a lot of wrestling
some of
around the
people
the
they've got at the convention. I mean, they're obscure by my standards, you know. I mean, we're at least active.
Is that, are we in our heyday? I think we might be in our heyday.
Maybe we've peaked.
We're fucked.
Oh, match number 9 of Wrestle Rock 86. Let's get back to what we do.
This is why we're in the fucking heyday. This is why this isn't our heyday, Mark. We're doing Wrestle Rock 1986.
You fucking know it.
Fucking hell.
Oh, Kamala with Skandor Akbar versus the America's champion, Sergeant Slaughter.
Yeah. Yes.
Kamala, in he comes. There's a man as he walks in flaunting his bum at Kamala. He's really patting it like that. And it looks more like an invitation than a diss when the guy does it. I was a bit like, that's confusing. I don't know how he wanted Kamala to react there. Someone also says something from the crowd that gets bleeped out.
Right, I think we all know what that was.
Better that
probably
is for the best.
Yeah,
all the best. And out comes Sergeant Slaughter.
Dogface makes it, though. Yeah. Dogface not only made it, it actually got subtitled. Because I think I think the network uses some kind of fucking AI deep thinking bollocks.
Yes, it does.
To make the subtitles. And they do a pretty good job.
Yeah.
A lot of the microphone work in this show is inaudible in parentheses.
Yeah.
But Dogface actually made it in the subtitles because it was so clear.
Dogface,
the computer picked it up.
But Dogface is one of those things that I think is almost like a term of endearment. And I think it's specifically around like amateur wrestling.
Really? Dogface?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, Rick Steiner was known as the Dogfaced Gremlin. I mean, just a terrible nickname that nobody questions, but Dogface does seem to be almost, I'm not sure whether it's like Flyboy in the American
airplane people.
Whether Dogface is a sort of thing like you're a sort of grunt at the coal face, I don't know.
I mean, Rick Steiner has got a dog's face.
Yes, he does, yeah. The Dogface Gremlin. He wasn't anything, there wasn't anything gremlin-like about him. He looked like a killer. out comes Sergeant Slaughter. He hands out little plastic USA flags. He has recently left the WWE, WWF, in the last couple of years because he wanted to sign a contract deal with G.I. Joe to become a spokesman and an action figure. and Vince McMahon had signed with
Sorry, what year
LJN.
Is this?
So this would have been
what year is this?
This would have been 84.
Oh, sorry, okay, right. I thought you meant now.
No.
Confusing.
So he left in 84 having had a really top run in the WWF, and you really do sort of see he's pretty much the only person on this card that you go, this guy seems like a proper star.
Yes.
He seems seems polished and he knows what he's about.
He knows where wrestling's going.
Yeah. He's left the WWF. And so he finds himself, you know, going down the card, but still being this iconic character.
Yeah.
I'd really forgotten when I was watching this how good Slaughter is. Mm. And he's not just good because he's a gimmick. He's great because he really sells in the ring.
It's Bossman, because we talk about Bossman being big, but like really selling, but he really sells in the ring.
He really does. Bossman, great seller. Sergeant Slaughter, a great seller. Mm. Nobody ever talks about, you need to rewatch, you know, hey you trainees, you know, you want to get and watch some of those tapes of, and they're always like, you want to watch Dory Funk and you want to, you know, you want to see that. You want to watch Sergeant Slaughter in the 80s when he would sell everything.
Yeah.
Kamala is so limited and yet he makes Kamala look like a killer, and he makes Kamala look so good. He's fighting against this monster is all down to the way that he sells, and he does it so well. Mm. Kamala is bad. He's a bad wrestler, Kamala, but he looks absolutely great. And the two of them working together, I mean, it's, you know, Sergeant Slaughter is selling like Kurt Hennig the whole time, top level selling, and it makes the match really, really work. Mm. Even though both of them, you know, certainly by 91, when we see them back in the WWF, are some of the worst performers in the history of the world. Sergeant Slaughter even does a drop kick in this, which is not great, but, you know, God bless him. He's obviously feeling it, which is nice. He does a slam on Kamala as well, and that gets probably the biggest reaction of the night so far.
Yeah.
Just the whole idea that someone has slammed Kamala, who was a great guy. Great part of the gimmick. The referee disqualifies Kamala in a pattern that we begin to see again and again here. The manager, Skander Akbar, gets hold of Sergeant Slaughter on the ropes, and Kamala goes to run into him, and Slaughter gets out of the way.
Yeah.
Kamala hits Skander Akbar. Mm. But the ref is like, come on. You're disqualified for touching Sergeant Slaughter. That is a perfect example of a bit where you sort of go, but sort of karmically, you know, he got his just desserts, and you would expect this match to continue.
Yeah.
It's a really annoying thing to do that. What they do here is you see that Slaughter knows exactly what he's doing, where he gets a belt off Kamala. No, it's a whip that Kamala has, and he just begins whipping him. And so the crowd are just like, well, this is great.
Yeah.
They've forgotten about the slightly...
About the history.
...fudged, shitting DQ. Yes. I don't think these people were ever aware that the history was bad.
Right, okay.
I think a lot of these people were very much... Although they are in the
we're
north.
We're in the north. Yeah,
they are in the north. Yeah, maybe I was wrong there to disparage them. Maybe they just don't give a fuck. Sergeant Slaughter then gets a load of kids to recite the Pledge of Allegiance.
Confusing. I don't know why that...
it's just part of his gimmick, isn't it? About America.
And I'm Russ Abbott. He looks like Russ Abbott.
I think he says, I want them to hear it in Libya as well. Which reminds you of all of the sort of like the things historic that problems. And those kids, when they first start off, they're nervous. And I was like, of course they don't know the Pledge of Allegiance, Matt. No, they do. They know it in full.
Do you remember when they managed to take down Topple Gaddafi and they got into his complex, and there was just this book filled with pictures of Condoleezza Rice.
Was there?
Yeah. I was thinking about it a few days ago because somebody shared a meme and Colonel Gaddafi happened to be there. Mm. And I was saying, it's just like, there was, when they got into his house, just this book that was filled. He seemed to be really into Condoleezza Rice. Very confusing. Just loads of pictures, like a scrapbook.
There is Condoleezza nothing more Rice. Fun than looking through the houses of dictators once they've been deposed.
Yeah.
It is really worth doing. Just Google it.
Oh, yeah. Hussein's kids' rooms where they've got, like, I think the kid had died, so he sort of blocked off his bed with like a glass perspex kind of fascinating. What's that about?
I mean, it's a bit like Osama bin Laden's house. Yeah. It's impossible not to look at that and go, oh, terrible rug. You know? for such a famous guy, he didn't manage to monetize it did he?
No.
not the biggest problem he
Somebody
had.
Pointed out, because there was pictures of Osama bin Laden in front of his bookshelves. So he had loads and loads of books and a couple of Kalashnikovs. and somebody pointed out that when Republicans are interviewed on the television, like proper fucking swivel-headed lunatics, they they're always pictured with like all their guns behind them, but true. Not as many books. Yeah. So Osama bin Laden had a better gun to book ratio than they did, weirdly.
If you look at the books, though, it's all just Dilbert compilations. The worst book. Really terrible.
I used to love Dilbert, but yeah, he's that bloke's gone a bit mad, hasn't he? Yeah,
they all go a bit mad. Yeah. They all do.
Humorists.
Yes. Whatever, cast
your
a
next
wry eye.
Dave Gorman.
Oh, match number 10. AWA Tag Team Champions Scott Hall and Kurt Hennig versus the Long Riders, Wild Bill Irwin and Scott Hogg Irwin. Hall comes out in that beautiful Ribera jacket. That is identical to the one that you got me. It is. It's exactly the same shade, exactly the same printing. Beautiful.
Scott Hogg's great in this. He looks like Magnum PI.
He really does, doesn't he? A huge Magnum PI. And what you can see here is they obviously have him pegged and going, well, we lost Hogan, but you know what? We've got Big Scott Hall.
Yeah.
Big Scott Hall. Yeah. He comes out to this match and they go, before we go any further, the Pro Wrestling Report has named Scott the most popular wrestler. And he gets a sort of a trophy.
Yeah.
Pro Wrestling Report was the in-house AWA magazine news that they put out. So Vern Gagne is basically like, I want to push this guy. So let's say he's one of the most popular wrestlers.
Give him a...
There's no way he was going to win that. He is in the tag team.
Yeah.
But they were trying to do the push here. Hall is very, very, very jacked and in great shape and tan compared to everybody else on the card. At this point, he really is green. He's in the early years of his career.
Yeah.
And they do very well in this match to hide the fact that he was not anything in the ring.
Mm.
That, you know, he was actually pretty bad. They put him with Kurt Hennig. Hennig is a second generation performer, one of the great in-ring performers of his generation. And when it came to selling, pretty much unsurpassed, apart from Slaughter is better in this match. But also a great, you know, competitor as Mr. Perfect, of course. So what you have here is Razor Ramon and Mr. Perfect when they were tag team champions at the start of their careers.
Yeah.
No one knows quite what happened, but Scott Hall does sort of disappear from the picture. There were rumours that I think he's talked about getting into nightclub sort of issues where someone got shot.
Right, okay.
I think, you know, if you Google that, you've got his story there. And I'm not prepared to go any further because I forgot to Google it before now. So I'm going to say,
he popped off and sex with loads of women for 10 years and then came back.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, you would do. And when he comes back, he's still as handsome. Slightly leaner, oddly taller, which is strange. Very odd.
And Cuban.
Yeah, it's happened to us all. Had a gap year, came back
Cuban.
Yeah, thought we were Indian. That's the worst people that I knew did that. Properly came back. Well, you know, they come back from like India gap years.
Oh, right. Thought that, yeah.
And they were basically what Russell. Confusing. Basically Russell Brand.
Russell Brand.
They're Russell Brand. Yeah. The worst type of people.
I'm going all day to where am I going? St. Lucia.
Oh, nice.
I'm going to come back like Michael Scott from The Office with a little plait in my hair playing the steel drum.
When we come back from Texas, we're going to just bring guns back.
Guns, bring guns back,
just guns.
Yeah.
Just guns.
And opinions.
Weirdly, this match, nothing really happens during the match. It's a strange one. There's a lot of headlocks and stalking one another.
Yeah.
And
there's shaking.
Yeah.
People getting shaked.
Yeah. There's a lot of sort of action and movement, but it doesn't seem to add up to anything.
Looking at Hogg Irwin's rotten arm bruises. They're horrible. Don't like them.
The Long Riders. Here they are. Wild Scott Irwin, he's wearing... Scott Hogg Irwin wearing black leggings and a black top, and then he's put trunks over which are like pastel blue, and it does just look like fucking underpants. It's really unpleasant, like a sort of Superman that's joined a bike gang and really, really let himself go. Scott Hogg Irwin, one of those guys who is a sort of odd footnote, but he would die within the year. He had a brain tumour.
Crazy.
So nothing to do with the business so much as just terrible luck.
Loaded.
His brother, Scott Irwin, one of those guys who, you know, just seemed like he would one day click somewhere and never got the chance somehow. He's a big guy. He's got a Barry Windham-esque build. He sort of looks a bit like The Undertaker because he's ginger and he's got a bit of a pot belly and it's a bit sort of like reddy pink.
Yeah.
You know, he has around the fringes of his body, things are red pink. That's like sort of a pale skin. But he always had the sort of cowboy gimmick that he did. He had a short run in the NWA where he was just glorified sort of, you know, jobber. And then he ultimately would have a short run in the WWF in the mid-90s as the Goon.
The Goon!
Who was a hockey player. And this was a raft of characters who were brought in basically to be enhancement talent, but to have quite basic gimmicks. So there was Tom Brandy brought in as Salvatore Sincere, and you had The Goon. They weren't supposed to be big headliners, no. But that was really it for him. Mm. I think he has since passed away. Just odd that he never made it, really. Mm. And I think you do wonder slightly, had his brother kept going, they seem like a tag team that would have been quite useful to slot into various promotions, but obviously that didn't happen. Mm. It ends with a very sloppy drop kick off the top rope by Kurt Hennig, which again at the time, spectacular move, didn't see much of that, and it does look real because it's messy enough, but he gets the pinfall. This match, I've seen a lot of stuff online are very much like, oh, this is the match of the night, and it wasn't for me at all.
It's very long, nearly half an hour,
inexcusable. Mm. And it was not as good as the US Express match that we saw earlier, which was absolutely cracking. Mm. Match number 11, Pete. Jesus Christ. Larry Zbysko versus Scott Ledoux with Kurt Hennig's dad, Larry, as the special referee.
Doing Ledoux.
After an intro by former Minnesota Viking Bob Lancelot, we have a little chat with Scott Ledoux. The guy is a boxer who became a wrestler, and he was a good boxer. Mm. He was nicknamed the Fighting Frenchman. You'd use that in wrestling. Apart from the fact that in wrestling, the French are known as cowards and losers, traditionally. Mm. That's been the gimmick. So he dropped that. He had his final bout in 1983, so a couple of years before this, against Frank Bruno.
All right.
Which he lost. I don't know what it is when you see Frank Bruno mentioned in sort of like a place you're not expecting. It's like sort of going, oh, I used to live next door to him. Yes. He just feels like someone who you know from your extended family, Frank. He was a proper boxer, though. He had a record of 34-12-4. He had fought Leon Spinks to a draw once in probably his greatest moment. And he'd had an exhibition with Muhammad Ali, which is actually his greatest moment. I said greatest moment before I then read the Muhammad Ali bit. And he lost to George Foreman and Larry Holmes. So he isn't just some guy who was, you know, fringy. He was a... if not a top flight boxer, at least a noted soup can who they would just pummel.
He did an exhibition match with Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
On point.
Amazing, isn't it?
Did you say that?
Sorry. I did, yeah.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I was looking at my notes.
No, it is worth mentioning again, because you'd see him in this ring with Larry Zbysko, and you're like, who is this fucking slug? And it's just, I mean, to be able to say, I was a boxer, and you go, oh, yeah, anything good? You know? Yeah, I did an exhibition match with Muhammad Ali.
I don't
Ali.
Understand exhibition matches, though. It's just kind of just...
Well, it's because I imagine, I'm making this up off the top of my head, but I imagine it was a time when Ali was not wanting to fight competitively. So you would just go in and have an exhibition, yeah.
It's weird, though.
It might be five rounds.
Why would you go and watch that?
Because people will. You'd go and watch Muhammad Ali fight, wouldn't you?
I would, yeah.
If it was against the person who runs like the bloody coffee shop over there.
Oh, mate, I'd be in that queue. Right behind him.
Oh, yeah. I wonder if his punches are as slow as his fucking soup. Very niche joke there.
I have just had some soup.
Yeah, it took a long time to arrive.
It's in a pan. Put it in a cup and then give it to me.
Yeah.
Well, what's the rigmarole about?
You know how to sort this, don't you? Ali, Bombaye. Ali, Bombaye. I'm going to come down on him like a ton of Idaho potatoes, says Scott Ledoux. And later on, after the match, he said, I wanted to knock him out for the Spudheads. So he's got...
Spudheads?
He's got a potato thing going on that they never talk about.
No.
I also checked, is he from Idaho? No. So I don't know why. He just loves potatoes. Got to get potatoes in. Remind people of how good taters are. This is he makes the jump from boxing to a very, very unexceptional wrestling career.
Yeah,
I don't think it's even mentioned in his Wikipedia entry at all that he went into wrestling. It does mention that he did ringside commentary for ESPN with the boxing. That is probably the connection that got him in the AWA.
Right.
And he has this sort of exhibition match here.
Is this the low quality version of like when MMA fighters come and wrestle?
Yeah, exactly that. And you can see a lot of the things they did at WrestleMania 2, celebrity guests and things, the AWA have tried to replicate.
On a budget.
Very much a budget. And hence Horse Breeder, hence, you know, your big matches, you get the commentator from ESPN to take part in a, you know, all of this is very bargain basement local Minnesota stuff compared to the WWE's national expansion. Mm. This match has European rules, which is 10 two-minute rounds with a minute's rest in between. Because the one thing this card needs is enforced timed downs. they are both wearing karate gloves. They talk nothing more
what
mid-80s
karate
anyway.
Gloves?
Karate gloves. Karate out comes gloves. Zabisco and he's wearing a satin G and he's got a Ninja Go with him. And I don't know who Ninja Go is. No. He doesn't do anything in this. I mean, stealing a living. you know, that sense of karate and boxing. What this is, basically, is the invention of MMA.
Yeah, okay.
You know, it's a wrestler versus a boxer in a sort of judo sort of trousers, you know. This is MMA being invented here. This is UFC Zero.
Well, this is about as successful as ever going to be, I think.
Yeah.
In many ways. Yeah.
This
12
is
minutes of it.
Also very similar to the match that Mr. T and Roddy Piper had at WrestleMania 2. It's a very, very bad carbon copy, if you like, you know, comparing the levels of the talent. You might wonder why Larry Zbysko, who is one of, you know, the good talkers and, you know, certainly a compelling ring performer, why he would be put in here. He was Vern Gagne's son-in-law. So Larry was always given quite plum roles.
Right.
Even though he was a legitimate, wrestling headliner over the years. He would be one of the people who was most loyal to the AWA because it was, by proxy, the family firm.
Yeah.
And he would be their last champion in about 1991. At which point everything was, you know, the kibosh was pulled.
Yeah.
I was reading about why the AWA folded, and it's a very complex story about some kind of lakeside property that Vern Gagne owned that was worth millions, which was compulsorily purchased by the local council so they could build a lakeside like amenity centre. And the second that he had it compulsorily purchased, he was like, I've got to pull the plug.
Yeah.
And I was like, I cannot follow what how this related here, to anything. But it was a strange way of doing it.
Yeah.
Zbysko does as good a job as he can do here.
Yeah.
Again, he sells really well. He's not ashamed of selling, and he will look like a coward, and he does get knocked over. And that makes this as good as it can be. It's not good.
It's not good.
Zbysko, you know, gets punched, the KO punch off the boxer, but he's saved by the bell, which is suddenly while the round system is there to allow that to happen. And again, they go outside. Zbysko throws him into the post, and he's immediately disqualified. Mm. I mean, so many disqualifications.
You shouldn't know how to do that.
Especially not in a match like this.
I know.
You know, this is the invention of MMA. Don't ruin it. He then attacks him with nunchucks after the nunchucks. My friend, my friend Robin had nunchucks. His brother was really, really into that sort of Bruce Lee sort of era. The mid-80s and the late-80s, you know, shurikens.
Well, my dad, with a straight face, told me that back in the day in the 80s, lads would go out in the street with nunchucks. I was like, going, it's not Double Dragon, Dad. I don't think they ever did that.
People used to take them out.
Did they?
Yeah, they did. I mean, I remember going out with like a gang of us lads.
Yeah,
we were going to the park. We were like nine.
Yeah, but as I said, no, my dad's saying that as in like grown men would be in the streets of a night out with their nunners.
But I think they would be. I think they would be because it was that thing of the Gottman and going, fucking hell, you know, OP doesn't know the karate, the one inch punch, you know, I've got my fucking nunchucks. You want some? They were. I never had a pair. And watching this, I was like, I can actually remember the feel of those slightly squishy foam nunchucks that they had a hard centre and they were there. And just watching that brought it all back. I was like, they were lovely to hold.
Oh, 80s dads had them. Like, I remember sort of going around mates' houses and there'd just be a single screw screwed into the wall and they'd just be hanging off them.
Yeah, used to see them all the time. I would not know where to get a pair of nunchucks now.
No.
And let me tell you, Pete, it's all I want now. It's
I'll get
all
you some
I want.
Nunchucks, mate.
Oh, man, we could just whack each other around the head with them. Really, really good.
Let's get them in Texas.
When kids did play with them, they were absolutely funny until I'd say one
get
swing
cracked
in every 20 would be lethal.
Get a cracking. Get a cracking.
It not only would go across your nose, but the chain would go round your ear and it would just tear all of that off in a strip. That was the 80s. AWA champion Stan Hansen versus Nick Bockwinkle is match number 12. This match kicks off. And let's remember all the entrances have been edited out and we've lost a Rockers match.
Right.
This match starts at the 3-hour mark. that is too long show. Bockwinkle had been the perennial AWA champion.
He got very excited at Bockwinkle then. Like, really?
I love the name Bockwinkle.
Bockwinkle.
Nick Bockwinkle. he was a perennial AWA champion. I don't think we've ever really talked about him.
Yeah.
He was a throwback performer. in that he felt very much like the champions of the past. He was very educated. He was a good speaker. He was a lovely, lovely wrestler. Very, very smooth, often a bad guy. And for a long time, he was managed by Bobby Heenan.
Yeah.
And the two of them were as close as Bobby Heenan was with anyone else. He thought the world of Nick Bockwinkel. Nick Bockwinkel thought the world of Heenan. Yeah. There is nothing about Nick Bockwinkel, really, that anyone has a bad word to say about him. He seemed like one of the few people who was properly educated and treated wrestling like a proper career.
Yeah.
And he made an awful lot of money doing it. He was responsible. He just seemed also, he was a different generation from everybody else who was around.
Yeah.
He seemed 10 years older. And I think he was probably, at this period, one of the very few clean people in wrestling.
Yeah.
He just seemed like a cut above everybody else, morally, physically, spiritually, mentally, all of those things. Because he was in the AWA and they didn't have, you know, TV in the same way that, the other federations did, and they didn't record all their stuff, his career is, you know, he's slightly not remembered as fondly as he probably should be, and certainly as he was perceived at the time. They really wrestle in this. Stan Hansen comes out, and Stan Hansen doesn't really need to be in America. He is making so much money in Japan, but he's come back as a sort of, like, you know, a bit of a favour to Baba, and he's also, well, I'd quite like to hold a world championship. And this match, your enjoyment of it depends whether or not you love Stan Hansen like I do. And I watched this match, and honestly, I thought this was so good. I thought it was... Hansen is just...
gross and unhinged and just kind of wild.
Always on the attack.
Yeah.
And some people are a bit like... I guess,
barrel-y.
He just goes for you. And what's great about this is Bockwinkel can't really wrestle the way he normally does, which is a handshake and then a long, slow build. And it's just like he's got to ride the storm and hopefully he can do something. And I thought this was really heated and really fun. This would have been, I think, state of the art for about 82.
Yeah.
And by 86, people don't really want to see stuff like this. They don't want to see big barrel-y men fighting men who are well into middle age in a cleverly worked out and heated debate. They just want to see, you know, power. They want to see gorilla press slams. They want to see blood. And they don't really want to see stuff like this, which I feel like this could have been a main event anywhere in the country for any point over the past 30 years. I mean, you get to this point and you go, this feels dated.
Yeah.
And that seemed like a shame.
Nick Bonkwinkle's whipping.
Bonkwinkle.
Bonkwinkle. Bonkwinkle.
I like it. Whipping him. I'd like to see that porno. the sordid title reign of Nick Bonkwinkle. That would be good. Really, because I think he's really, really gorgeous. I really do. He's so urbane. Just feel safe with him. He's gorgeous. Hansen makes people work for these matches.
Yeah.
If you get a match with Stan Hansen, he is going, you're going to make some money out of this. You're going to be getting main event money.
Yeah.
You're going to fucking work for it.
He's fresh off the plane.
Oh,
from Japan.
I get the impression as well, like, a lot of the time differences have made Stan like an angry wasp.
He lives within time.
He is just thumping about. The famous thing about Stan Hansen is that he is terribly short-sighted. And there's lots of talk that was why he was so stiff, because he just didn't know where people were.
Right.
So he was like, I'm not going to try it. And they've turned out to actually be a foot further away. I'm just going to try and get it as close as I can to them. A lot of people said that this was Stan Hansen inventing a backstory for why he beat you up.
Yeah.
No one's quite sure.
Yeah. But I'm very sure. It's like, get some fucking contact lenses on you.
Oh, no, I can't do that. I can't do that because I wouldn't be able to see them to put them in. you're just trying now. You're just trying. Pete, another DQ for going over the top rope intentionally.
Yeah.
The idiots, the stupid idiots.
I enjoyed this match kind of. I never liked sleeper holds, but these look really dangerous.
They did.
These look really kind of like, oh, he's really getting passed out. So well done, Stan, for selling on
There's
that
no
one of them.
Section in this match that you could say, oh, that was a classic.
Yeah.
But all of it is really good. Yeah. And when you describe it, it's just like, oh, they're against the ropes and Stan Hansen's hitting him. It doesn't get across how good that actually is.
Yeah.
He just does such a good job. It would turn out for the AWA, Stan Hansen was not the big success they needed him to be. And it was because internally everything broke down. So in June, Stan Hansen refused to drop the belt to Nick Bockwinkel.
Right.
Nick Bockwinkel had held it, I think, three times previously. But he refused to do it because he was just about to tour Japan. And he said, I've been billed there as being the AWA champion. And to lose it now would be like false advertising.
Yeah.
And they were a bit like, oh, come on. What, you suddenly care about sort of false advertising? This is bullshit. And there was basically a thing where Hansen was a little bit like, I am so big in Japan that any loss will hurt me.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to take that risk, was basically his thing. So he refused to drop the belt. Vern Gagne just went, well, okay, we're going to strip you of the belt.
Yeah.
So I'm awarding it to Nick Bockwinkel. When things like that happen, you're walking on dangerous territory, because when you just go, the champion's stripped and I've awarded it, people at this time would go, but this is an important belt. You know, why is he just giving it to that guy?
Yeah.
And there would have been, you know, things like that were bad decisions. All the wrestling companies, even WCW, they end not because one thing goes wrong. They end because a thousand things, tiny little things that individually are unimportant. They coalesce and eventually it's too much.
Right.
And that's what you see with the AWA. When you award the championship to someone rather than have them win it, that is one of those little cracks that appears. What the problem was, they needed the actual physical title belt back from Stan Hansen, who by this time was in Japan. And Hansen absolutely refused to send it back. He was like, no, I haven't lost it.
A lot of big kind of decisions. Like, we've seen this before, like people not sending stuff back and keeping all this. And it's like, guys, this shouldn't be part of the issue.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be part of the issue.
What it always comes back down to is everybody just wants to be given some money. They're like, well, I've got you over a barrel.
I've got something,
This is wrestling. You know what happens here. Promoters have got fat off us over the years. Vern Gagne has made a lot of money out of me.
And if I now I've got
something
cuts,
he wants, you know, will you send it back? Will I send it back? Absolutely not. but we can talk about it. Vern Gagne says, well, I'm going to instigate legal action. So Hansen does actually return it.
Right.
Although Nick Bockwinkel said Hansen did run it over with his truck a few times before he sent it back. He was just like a big baby. We then get another main event. I mean, this just doesn't stop. Match number 13, Nord the Barbarian, who was a guy called John Nord, who would later have a run in the WWF as the Berserker, the big Viking.
Oh, yes, okay.
And King Kong Brody versus Jimmy Snuka and Greg Gagne.
Yeah.
Greg Gagne replaces a seriously injured Jerry Blackwell, they say, and if Garnier's team win, then Vern Gagne, his father, gets 10 minutes in the cage with Sheikh Adnan Al-Qassim. That's the that's
what
the
he
thing.
Wants.
King Kong Brody, better known as Bruiser Brody. In the AWA in Minneapolis, he used the name King Kong Brody because Minneapolis was the home of Dick the Bruiser.
Right.
Dick the Bruiser was the biggest wrestling star in the world.
Yeah.
If you were from Minneapolis. He really was. There's a statue to him just in Minneapolis to Dick the Bruiser.
Yeah, cool.
They have, I think, Crusher as well, who was the other big star. Dick the Bruiser's tag team partner. There's, if not a statue of him, there certainly is a Crusher Day, where they have, like, you know, a day where it's just like Polish food is served. There's polka music. They are culturally as important as any wrestler in any part of the United States.
Yeah.
So Bruiser Brody, famous name, couldn't use the word Bruiser because it was too much. It would be like Big Daddy V, Viscera, and in the latter part of his career, coming to Britain and it being billed as Big Daddy V.
Yeah.
And people would go, what, Big Daddy? It's the same here. So he becomes King Kong Brody when he's working in Minneapolis. Jimmy Snuka has come over from the WWF after some, shall we say, legal difficulty regarding a murder he committed.
Yeah.
Yes, let's. and teams with Greg Gagne, who is the overpushed and useless son of the AWA promoter Vern Gagne. The other wrestlers did not like or appreciate the nepotism. They've already been through it with Vern Gagne, but at least he was running the territory and was responsible for the purse strings. Mm. Now he's saying, put over my son. You see him when he's in there with Brody. He is much, much more slender. He is at least a head shorter than everybody else.
Yeah.
And even though he's trying as hard as he can, it's just a total mismatch. Again, there is no way that this guy would have been pushed at that level had his father not been controlling the decision to push him at that level.
Yeah.
Nepotism is awful in everything. In wrestling, it's really apparent as well.
Mm.
This match is a big old mess. but it's fine.
Yeah.
It's the level of passion gets you through it. And it ends with Nord falling over Gagne, and then Snuka makes the pin. This is a match that has a murderer and the victim of a murder.
Oh, yeah, right, okay.
A sort of unusual a little bit. Snuka and Brody had been a tag team as well. They'd taken part in the All Japan tag tournaments in the early 80s.
Mm.
So there was actually a tag team with a murderer and a murder victim,
which
is a strange little thing.
Because like Bruce Brody, he is so hefty.
He is.
It seems, I know getting stabbed is, it's destructive. But it sounded very much like that situation was just the paramedics didn't arrive in time. But like you do, so it was like an hour before someone arrived. Someone's been stabbed. Like they're gonna probably fucking bleed out and die. But like he's so big, I cannot imagine one stab wound would take that guy out. I don't know why.
No, absolutely,
it just strikes me as sort of being very unlikely.
It does in the basement of a stadium in Puerto Rico in 1988. He will be in circumstances that are still very mysterious and unclear to this day. He would be stabbed by a Puerto Rican wrestler by the name of Invader One. I forget his name. I'm not going to say it because if I get it wrong and it's a Jose. Or a Jorge. There's someone who's going to be like, hey, that wasn't fucking me, dude. Brody is one of my personal favourite wrestlers. Mm. Everything he's in is great because he's one of those guys who, again, like Stan Hansen, has intensity and he brings believability to it. And his ability to do the right thing to get the crowd to react is astonishing. One of the guys, he just did not trust promoters, and it made him a rebel and a sort of just the last
sensible,
the last huge headliner who never really wanted to work for anybody, and that made him a bigger headliner. He was talking at the time of his death. There was talk that he may possibly have come in for a run with the WWF to face Hulk Hogan, and you know that would have been a run that probably wouldn't have enhanced his standing. But you see him at times like this, and this guy was a headliner all over the world. And even in this, if you showed this to someone who'd never seen wrestling before, they would pick out and they would go about Brody. They'd go, well, he's the best one in this.
Yeah.
And you can see that. It's just a shame. I mean, you look at the rest of the match and it's the fucking Berserker, Jimmy Snuka and Greg Gagne. There's only so much you can do to make this match work. Very bad news. But Snuka gets the pin. And that paves the way for us to have Vern Gagne taking on Sheikh Adnan Al-Kassi. Kassi had known Saddam Hussein when he was in Iraq as a young wrestler.
Oh, yes.
He does become General Adnan in the WWF.
Yeah, didn't he organise a match out there as
well?
That's
right, so he was a pal of Saddam Hussein. But the problem is, at this time, Iraq is not on the list of enemies of the US.
No.
It's very much Iran and Libya. So the fact that he represents all of the Middle East.
Yeah.
He will take on the whole of the sins of the Middle East, even though he comes from a country that everyone's actually fine with. A little bit like Nikolai Volkov coming from Lithuania. He then takes on the mantle of the hated Soviet Union. although as a Lithuanian, Volkov was very anti-communist, part of the reason he came to the USA. Adnan is he's had a career prior to this, prior to playing up the Middle Eastern bad guy. He was playing a Native American. He was known as Billy White Wolf in the WWF and actually held the WWF Tag Team Championship. What he's noticed, what they've noticed at this time is the 1980s, if you were from the Middle East and you worked in the wrestling business, it was a license to print money.
Yeah.
You were overnight the main event. So from 1980-81 onwards, if you were of Arabic extraction, you could write your own check for how much you were going to make. I mean, you would walk into anyone's, if not main event, top level of the card just because you were hated and you were the real thing.
Yeah.
It is a proper sense of like therapy. All of these people in the audience, they get to yell and scream at the thing they are taught to be frightened of and to despise, and you are that. You will take all of that hatred, and your promoter will then pay you handsomely for doing so. And promoters all over the country will want you to stand in their arena so all the people can make themselves feel better by screaming abuse at you.
God bless America.
Oh, what an 80s Adnan Al-Kassi and Skandar Akbar must have had. Just tremendous. And of course, you know, the king of that, the Iron Sheik.
Iron Sheik,
what a career that man had. It's his 80th birthday really soon.
Is it?
The Iron Sheik, yeah.
It was celebrating in a car with, was it Brutus? I can't remember.
Hacksaw Duggan.
Hacksaw Jim Duggan?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, hated enemies.
Whoa.
That's partly the reason they were so angry about it.
Good.
Was, Mr. USA is there with the Iron Sheik and they're having a massive bifter. Having a great old time. Also a bag of cocaine found.
Yeah, that was why.
Yeah. Duggan also has said over the years, I didn't take any of that. So it really was Sheik's fault. And Sheik has always been like, oh, fucking
bullshit.
Yeah, fucking bullshit.
Fucking bullshit.
Make you humble. Break your back. he was very much like, you know, Duggan did plenty of it. Don't you worry.
Don't you worry about that.
Oh, the old feud's going again.
Never guess what he did it off. Oh, fucking 2 before of it.
I can picture that. What you say, and I was just thinking that horrible image of two men with a plank of cocaine.
Like a taste, like a little craft ale tasting bar.
Duggan going, death to America. And Sheik going, no, that's funny. That's very funny. the swap. Very good, very good. Van Gogh gets Al Cassie in the ring, gets to be the surrogate for the audience, just pummel the shit out of him. This isn't a match. It's just a sort of big beating. He shows Al Cassie no mercy at all. Van Gogh is a tough old bird, but he, at this point, is very bald. He is... He's getting the body of an old man, even though he's been wrestling all these years.
Yeah.
He busts open Al Cassie, and he then, again, badly booked. You should just have this be your absolute pasting. Mm. And Vern Gunny should stick his foot on Al Cassie's chest, and they should get the pinfall. Yeah. And instead, Al Cassie has a bit of a rally, and Vern Gunny just goes, well, roll up.
That's my baggage. Bends him.
After it, Vern Gunny gets out of the ring and says, okay, well, that's it for me. Yeah. I am going to retire. I know I've said it before, but I am going to retire now, and thank you very much, and I enjoyed that.
Don't tell us that you said it before.
Back a month later, please. Back in a month.
Lovely.
Annoyingly, he's back
cannot
in a month.
Stay away.
I think he only has 3 or 4 matches, and then he's like, oh, no,
all
I am
over
done.
Again. Jeez.
Yeah. What is an interesting little bit of trivia, and unpalatable and sort of disgraceful. Vern Gagne wasn't, at this point, a murderer, but would become one.
Oh.
He is, I think, in his 60s here. Mm. But in 2009, he was in a rest home suffering from Alzheimer's. And he got into an altercation with a fellow resident of the what's it called? The clinic, the unit. Mm. He was a 97-year-old called Helmut Gutmann, who was a chemist. And Vern Gagne threw him to the floor. Gutmann injured his hip and head. And he went to the hospital. He lived a little while, but he did die as a result of his injuries.
Yeah.
The family didn't want to press charges. Daughter of the late Helmut Gutmann said, Vern Gagne shouldn't be held responsible for his role in my dad's death because he has Alzheimer's disease. Therefore, I don't believe the police should press criminal charges against him.
Right.
They didn't. You know, he was in the latter stages of dementia. He didn't last very much longer. But it is just, I like to throw it in there. I mean, this is a card that has, I think, more
so much,
serious sort of, well, there are more incidents of murder in it than anything that we've come across ever since.
Yeah.
All in very different circumstances, which makes it very interesting to hear.
It is.
If
that
not,
guy was like 97.
Yeah.
I'm reading about it. 97.
Yeah. So wow. Vern Gagne was 82 when it happened. But, obviously Lordy. Both men had been had their faculties largely stripped, which is the horrors of Alzheimer's. It turns Vern Gagne into a murderer. The final, I'm so glad they changed the order of the matches. Imagine going out on that. Imagine. This is a match that actually took place before the main event and the Vern Gagne. This is the Road Warriors versus the Freebirds, Michael P.S. Hayes and Jimmy Jam Garvin.
And obviously these people are very famous, but it's just the way it's filmed, you just can't see it.
You can't.
Can't see anything. Can't see anyone's face paint.
This is a big mess, this match. I mean, there is a slight rub against the Road Warriors, which is they looked amazing. Mm. They had a great aura. And they were brilliant if you glanced at the television and looked away.
Yeah.
Their matches are by and large dog shit. And this is a perfect example of that. It is all sizzle, no psychology. Mm. It's just crashing into each other. There is nothing really to just get your grip on.
Yeah.
You're just watching a lot of smash, smash, smash. And it doesn't have any build or any dips or any... It's just chaos to some degree. I did watch Michael Hayes in this, and it struck me again. I mean, he has had a fascinating career. He had proper main event level runs pretty much everywhere he went. And he's been backstage with the WWE for decades now. I mean, he really is one of those people you just want to sit down for a 5-hour shoot interview and be honest. And I think that's the problem, because I think he is probably as full of shit as anyone that you've ever met. He looks like he would just be really arrogant and really sort of like a liar, and just like, you know, stupid and just a prick and all of that. And I was thinking, it's such a shame that someone who's done so much couldn't be less of an asshole. Yeah. I just, there couldn't be more of an arsehole either. That works both ways
yeah,
around.
Yeah, it does,
The quirk of English that we've discovered on this show. It's not been a total waste of time.
It's like QI, this.
This match did nothing for me, I must admit.
No, I watched 4 hours of this, I don't need any more.
Exactly that. It's exhausting. After this is their last big stadium show, and it would be a slow process, but the AWA, they could not keep the momentum. This in some ways was their peak in this era of putting on a show this big and actually buggering it up quite badly in a lot of ways. And I think in ways that weren't immediately noticeable at the time.
Yeah.
By the end of 1986, the AWA are in worse shape than ever before. They've had the issue with Stan Hansen. They've given the belt to Bockwinkel. They are beginning now to lose even more talent to the WWE. Over the next few years, they'll lose Kurt Hennig. They'll lose the Rockers. Anyone who was young and had potential is snapped up almost immediately by one of the other two big promotions. Mm. And they do decline quite rapidly. And within 5 years after this, it will be all over.
Yeah.
It will have been a slow death as well. They were basically over by 88, and then they just hang on till 1991. By the end, you are seeing things like Sergeant Slaughter being involved in a sort of weird Survivor Series that runs for week after week after week with impossible, like, you know, point system scoring. They will have an uncooked turkey on a pole match that takes place between Colonel De Beers and I think a guy called Derek Miller. You know, it just becomes a real parody of what it had been before. Team Challenge series as well, Pete, is one of the funniest things on the network. I've watched some of it and it is hilarious. It's a bargain basement promotion that doesn't realise that death has already visited it. And it thinks, do you know what? If we can just get through this next week, maybe everything will become better. And it's magic. I have a feeling they didn't finish the team series because it folded down.
Right.
So I think it hung in the air, which is even funnier.
Let's finish it. Let's get everyone together and finish it.
Get the old gang back. Yeah. Unfortunately, Vern Gagne will not be joining us. Look, that was AWA WrestleRock 86. Mm. Fascinating, I thought. Difficult to watch.
It's better to look. Don't watch it. It's bad.
Yeah,
but I hope you took some scant enjoyment from our little production.
You know, you got to hear about some murders.
Yeah,
you got to hear about some little people wrestling.
Yeah,
you got to hear about Harley Race having. I'm already into the bits about the wrestling not being very good. What a nightmare. Look, until next time. We're in the middle now of February.
Yes.
Yes, that's exciting. Mm. So next month, we are going to be starting the preparations.
The preps.
For the biggest trip of the year.
And I know people like wrestling, they like going to stuff, and it's going to sound like we're showing off. We're not. We're just excited, and we are trying to put a bit back into the product effectively.
You know
we're trying to invest.
You know it.
We cash.
I am just looking forward to being able to go. Oh,
and I have used my air miles.
We're recording loads of bits. Little bits.
Yeah, little bits.
Oh my God, who did we see? D'Lo Brown. What was D'Lo Brown eating? Cereal. But aren't you staying in an Airbnb? Why is D'Lo Brown in your No more questions.
Wrestlers, surprisingly, don't make a lot of money. So whatever you offer them. Do you want to buy a cereal in an Airbnb? Yes, I do.
Oh yes, there's more to it than that. Don't you worry. Don't you worry, D'Lo. You won't be nodding your head so back and forth excitedly when you hear what I've got planned. Oh, man. Poor D'Lo Brown.
Oh.
The hardest $20 he's ever earned. Until next time, wrestle me big.
Wrestle me Mark.
WrestleMe is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.